This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today, we're interviewing Rick Steiner. He's a retired professor from the University of Alaska in marine conservation and now conducting the Oasis Earth Project, working with NGOs, governments, industry, and civil society to speed the transition to an environmentally sustainable industry and society, and to speed the transition to an environmentally sustainable society. So welcome, Rick. It's good to be talking with you up there in Alaska. How are things going?
It's great to be with you, Jay, and hello, Bozeman.
Are you getting the heat that we're getting down here?
We are not, actually. You know, here we're in mid-July, and it's been cool and rainy. It's in the 50s here in the south coast of Alaska, the northern part. Of course, we'd have snow any day, but we've had a pretty cool summer. We've had a bunch of wildfires still, 100-plus acres have burned, but we're welcoming the rain right now.
Are you in Anchorage or somewhere else?
Yeah, I'm in Anchorage now. That's right.
Okay. Well, you have a remarkable portfolio that begins with your work as a marine advisor for the Prince William Sound region of Alaska from 1983 through 1997. So what took you into that job and what did it involve?
Well, yeah, actually, before I started in Prince William Sound with the university, I was on the university faculty and they stationed me in the Arctic. Uh-huh. I was the first full-time science faculty member for the university stationed full-time in the Arctic in a Inupiat community called Kotzebue on the northwest Alaska coast, and working with the local indigenous people around the Arctic coast of Alaska on issues that they were concerned about, where science could sort of interact and help them, Western science could help them think through these problems a little more clearly. And so then I moved to Prince William Sound in 83, 84 in that period, in a small fishing town of Cordova, no roads to it again. To work with the local people within that region, the commercial fishing industry, the Alaska Native community, villages, communities, different industries, tourism industry, and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System that has a terminal in Prince William Sound, quite infamous terminal these days. So the idea was to, you know, universities have three principal missions. One is education, that's the on-campus, four-credit undergraduate and graduate education, then research, second mission, then third mission is extension, and that's to put faculty members out in the real world, off-campus, working with civil society, applying information and knowledge and hopefully wisdom and science in some of these issues that people are concerned with. And it's a kind of a really cool aspect of universities, actually. So it's putting information and knowledge to work in civil society. That's what the task was in Prince William Sound as well.
Were you doing some research as well?
Yeah. Some of the issues we identified through the fishermen there and such. I was also commercial fishing occasionally at the time. I first moved to Alaska as a king crab and snow crab fisherman out of Kodiak. But we identified a couple of issues, and that is marine mammal commercial fisheries interactions. We did a project experimenting with acoustic harassment devices to keep sea lions and seals away from salmon gill nets on the Copper River Delta. Modest success with that. But then also killer whales, orcas, were taking black cod, a sablefish, which is a deep water fish, bottom fish, off the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea coast. And the killer whales were very good at long liners would string their long lines out, and when they're hauling them up, the killer whales would come strip every black cod off the line when it got up into their range. And so myself and a colleague who studies killer whales, we tried to sort out how to, whether there was a benign way of keeping the killer whales from doing this. And we tried several things with these acoustic signals and such. And what we figured out very quickly is the whales were just too smart, and there was no way of doing it effectively other than stopping hauling long line gear while the whales were around, switching to pots rather than long lines and things like that. So, but then also, I got involved in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System terminal and tanker issue in the early 1980s, the ballast water treatment facility, the vessel traffic system and such. And we were concerned then about the possibility of a loaded super tanker grounding and having a major catastrophic oil spill. And then we were also, local fishing community was very concerned about clear-cut logging of the coastal temperate rainforest that had just begun in the late 1980s in the region. This is the very northernmost extent of the coastal temperate rainforest, and logging had just started. A lot of people were concerned about how to stop that. And ironically, we used the oil spill monies to do that. But that's another story.
Yeah. Well, the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened in 1989. So how did you get involved in that?
Well, yeah, the morning of the spill, that's March 24, 1989, still cold, still snow on the ground. I was getting ready to go out with the Department of Fish and Game to do what we call a fry dig, to go around and survey the many salmon streams in Prince William Sound to see how the salmon eggs that incubate in the stream gravel over winter, and then what the success of the previous year's reproductive process was. I was getting ready to do that, and got the word very quickly that there was a tanker on Bly Reef, fully loaded, oil coming out. So I jumped, I grabbed a float plane, flew over the tanker, circled a few times, and then we went and landed in Valdez, and I was trying to sort out who was doing what where, and I found where Exxon had set up. They had just gotten there and set up a command center at a local hotel down in the harbor, and I walked through their door and introduced myself to Exxon Shipping Company president and his staff, and told them, look, we're there to help, whatever they need. They said, look, whatever you guys need. And so we formed with the Coast Guard and the state of Alaska, Exxon, and the local fishermen, that myself and a few colleagues represented, a command team to direct the response to the spill. And there were some interesting dynamics on that. It was the commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard from Washington, D.C., the State Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, the Exxon staff, and a few of us from Cordova, Alaska. And so we basically did everything we could to try to contain the oil, get booms in the water, skimmers. A lot of that wasn't working. They didn't have any of it there. They weren't able to deploy it. It was a total mess, to be honest with you. But even when we got hundreds of miles of big ocean booms to try to cordon off these precious bays and natural wild salmon streams to try to protect them from the oil coming into their area. And some of that was modestly successful. We put booms around the hatcheries to try to protect them. That was modestly successful. But most of it was a failure. Most of the response to the Exxon Valdez spill was an utter failure. Maybe 5 or 6 or 7% of the volume of spilled oil was actually recovered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So most of it stayed in the environment, caused an enormous amount of environmental harm. It was right at the biological spring in Prince William Sound. All the herring were coming in to spawn. The sea otters were popping. The harbor seals were popping. The whales and seabirds had come, humpback whales and such had come back from southern latitudes, and the salmon were coming out of the streams, and adult salmon were on their way back to the Prince William Sound streams, and it couldn't have happened at a better place at a worse time.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the damage was extraordinary. Even to date, probably certainly one of the most damaging marine oil spills in human history, if not the most damaging. We still, 35 years later, have environmental damage where several species are not recovering at all. There's still oil in the beaches. And so, you know, it kind of refocused the paradigm of oil spills. Everybody had thought up until then that oil spills were an ephemeral, sort of a short-term, acute injury to the environment, but they recover very quickly, the injured environment does, and that's no longer the understanding. So you
were involved in setting up the Prince William Sound Science Center. Was that an outgrowth of the oil spill?
Well, actually, there were several institutions. A couple of them we had proposed before the Exxon Valdez. One was the Citizens Advisory Council, and I proposed that to the oil industry and to the state government and Coast Guard 2 years before the Exxon Valdez that would involve local citizens, you know, stakeholders in Prince William Sound, providing oversight to the oil industry and to the government. And the oil industry, the president of Alyeska, the pipeline owners told me to get lost. Why do I want citizens breathing down my neck? We've got this. It was extraordinarily arrogant, as many of the oil company executives tend to be. And even state government dismissed it. But anyway, we tried to set up a citizens advisory council for the oil terminal and tankers before the Exxon Valdez. We were successful in getting that established immediately afterward. Secondly, we had a couple of us had started the formation of a Prince William Sound Science Center before the Exxon Valdez spill. And, of course, after the spill, there was a lot of impetus and money flowing around, and we were successful at establishing it then. So those are two positive outcomes of the Exxon Valdez. The most important stuff, though, that came out of Exxon Valdez were the prevention systems that were put in place, and everybody in the area was involved in the establishment of these. And one was the ship escort response vessel system by the tanker companies and the terminal owner, Alyeska. And it's about a $60 million a year tug escort and response vessel system that escorts every loaded tanker out to the ocean entrance of the sound. And their job is to make sure that if there's a loss of steering or power failure on the tankers, they can render a tow to keep it out of harm's way immediately. They are available to make sure the tanker stays in the tanker lanes, which the Exxon Valdez did not. And they also have immediate first response, spill response equipment on board. So there was that. Then there was the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, passed in the U.S. Congress, and a number of us were intimately involved in that. Mm-hmm. And that required double hulls on all oil tankers in the U.S., a phase out of single hull tankers, a phase in of double hull tankers, which are much safer in events of groundings and collisions as far as oil spills are concerned. And then that was adopted internationally, globally, by the International Maritime Organization years later. So now all oil tankers globally, as a result of Exxon Valdez and the work many of us did then, are double hulled. So a couple of real success stories after Exxon Valdez, putting in the safe system for the area. But I would have to say that there's a lot of area of the Alaska coastline that this lesson in Prince William Sound was not applied to, and that includes the Aleutians and the Bering Strait between Russia and Northwest Alaska. The Aleutians has 20 times the ship traffic than we have in Prince William Sound right now, and these are ships traveling from the west coast of North America to Asia and back again. They travel through the southern the Aleutian Islands as on the Great Circle Route. And these are, some of them are petroleum product vessels, chemical tankers, but all of them have this heavy fuel on board. And if they wreck and spill, there's a lot of major oil spill to deal with. We've had a couple of instances of that. So the Aleutians are not better protected. We don't have these escort tugs and rescue tugs stationed out there. And the same with Bering Strait. With the increase in Arctic shipping due to declining sea ice, there's a lot more shipping coming through Bering Strait these days. And we're very worried that if there was a loss of power or steering, something like happened with the Dolly in Baltimore Harbor, you know, last spring, something like that happens in Bering Strait, you don't have the ability, the right vessel there to render a save. So we learned the lesson in Prince William Sound, but we haven't extrapolated that to other waterways in Alaska.
Was it as a result of your work there in the wake of the oil spill that the legislature gave you a commendation certificate in 2011?
Yeah, I believe that was that they did. It's a rare move by a very conservative Alaska state legislature to give a commendation to a environmental scientist. But I was very honored to have that happen. That was in 2011. It was right after I resigned from the university. I think it also had to do with the circumstances around my resignation from the university. The university administration had terminated some of my federal funding due to my outspoken public stance in opposition to offshore oil drilling in Bristol Bay specifically, but throughout Alaska's offshore waters in general. And we got into a squabble about that. And, you know, I contended that their response to my public teaching, which was part of my portfolio, my work assignment, was a violation of academic freedom, which is the very most sacrosanct principle of any university anywhere, is to honor that faculty have the right and responsibility to seek and teach their truth without fear and without favor. And the university administration, which gets most of their money from oil here, had just kind of had enough. And so anyway, they wouldn't back down, so I resigned. And I think that's where the legislature came up with this citation honoring the work that I had done as sort of an implicit apology, but not an overt one.
Mm. Yeah, it's kind of odd that the legislature, in the wake of your resignation from the university because of conflict, would give you the commendation. But I guess they really appreciated the work you had done.
Well, I guess at least some of them must have. You know, sometimes politicians will try to appear benevolent when they really feel otherwise. And, you know, issuing a citation, a commendation like this is an easy thing for them to do. But when it really comes down to it, their funding of the university with oil revenues and that political context that it gives the university is the problem. And that the university, when it came, push came to shove, the university did not honor its academic freedom principles and instead caved to political pressures from the state government to make it impossible for me to stay along. I had a tenured professorship too, but I just wasn't going to participate in any university that behaved that way. So at any rate, it's been fine. Once I got out of the university 2 months later, the Deepwater Horizon occurred in the Gulf of Mexico, and so I was immediately down there working on that and able to do things that I would not have been able to do had I still been on the faculty up here. So in a way, it worked out fine.
Well, according to your biography, you've worked all over the world. So tell us about the various countries you've worked in and what you've been doing there.
Yeah, well, I have been very fortunate to have been asked to help out all over the world on many different marine conservation issues, oil spill prevention response issues, oil spill restoration issues, and just environmental conservation issues in general. And this is from governments and the World Conservation Union, who I used to be a member on a committee with, the United Nations I've worked with, several governments and NGOs around the world. And Pakistan brought me over there to work with them on the Tasman Spirit oil spill in the south of Karachi in the Arabian Gulf in 2003, 2004. The Canary Islands government, I worked with them on an offshore drilling proposal there. I've done a lot of work for over the past 20 years in the Niger Delta, which is a very fascinating place. There's no place in the world that has been more severely impacted by oil than the Niger Delta. And the people have been sort of ignored by their government. The government is a co-owner of the oil projects, and so their allegiance is to oil revenue and oil production, not to the 30 million people that live in abject poverty in the Delta. I worked with the Lebanese government during the 2006 war with Hezbollah, between Israel and Hezbollah and Beirut and South Lebanon, and I was there during the war at the very last days of it. There was a major oil spill from an Israeli airstrike on the fuel tank farm for the Beirut power station that flowed into the Mediterranean and north past Syria and Cyprus and such. So I helped Lebanon, the government of Lebanon, during that. Papua New Guinea, Australia, the Baltics, Russia. I've worked throughout Russia on many things. And I tell you, it's been a fascinating, there are many, many unique aspects of all this. And it's intriguing. And I've always felt that I can be of more use internationally.
Tell us more about what you did at home, Russia. So. Tell us more about Russia, the work you did there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've been involved in the Russian Far East back since, the 1990s, when it first opened up after Perestroika and Glasnost and after the fall of the Soviet Union. Several instances of what worked with a World Conservation Union shell project on the Western Gray Whale in the Sea of Okhotsk, and planned sighting of an offshore oil platform right in the middle of their critical habitat. I was advising that project, and then also helping with commercial fisheries development in Sakhalin Island in the Russian Far East. As well, I testified at the Russian Duma, which is their Congress in Moscow, on things that are kind of out of my pay grade, things like macroeconomic policy for the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. But their fascination was with our Alaska Permanent Fund, by which we take 50% of all annual revenues from oil and deposit it into our permanent fund. We've been doing that here in Alaska for 40 years, and now it's a $80 billion fund from which every citizen gets an annual dividend. The Russians were very interested in that and gave a lecture to the Russian Academy of Sciences Economics Department on that. Again, not my forte. I'm a marine conservation biologist. But this was an easy one for Russia to get its head around. And I do think they did establish some sort of a fund afterward. I've also given oil spill prevention and response restoration workshops in St. Petersburg and some other areas throughout Siberia. I did an international expertise, a technical expert review of a Russia-China pipeline, which successfully rerouted the pipeline from a very pristine area south of Lake Baikal to north of Lake Baikal, a much safer route. And so many, many different instances working in Russia, and the Russian people that I work with were just absolutely fantastic. The government, is subjected to its political whims and winds, such as ours is too. So that's a different beast altogether. But the people I worked with in Russia were wonderful.
Is your expertise primarily in the area of preventing oil spills, whether on land or at sea?
That's one of the focal points of my work, certainly. Prevention, response, damage assessment. The United Nations, after my work in Pakistan, asked me to write a manual for the United Nations on oil spill damage assessment and restoration. And I did that. This is in 2005, 2006, and this was published by UNEP and IMO. And so that's used by all governments, all UN member governments throughout the world. So that certainly is one focus. But broader issues are, financial flows from energy, from oil and gas, forest conservation, habitat protection, endangered species protection in those areas where that's a pertinent issue. I did get involved in the deep sea mining issue in the Southwest Pacific, working in Papua New Guinea. There was a proposal to do a deep sea mining project on a sea floor massive sulfide mound at a deep sea hydrothermal vent there. The local people were dead set against it. The government kind of got pulled into it financially, as governments are prone to do. And my work was advising the local tribes about the risks and reviewing the impact statement for that project. And finally, the project did get canceled for financial reasons primarily, but there was a lot of pushback from the people in Papua New Guinea about that. So it's kind of a broad spectrum. I worked on mining issues in Central America, where the mining company was involved in perpetrating some violence against local activists who were opposing the mines, and the whole spectrum of issues. So it's been quite a ride.
What's your experience with respect to countries that are or aren't concerned about endangered species that are on the verge of being lost?
Well, it's a mixed bag, of course. The irony and the pain here is that most of the areas with very rich biodiversity and very threatened and endangered species are those very areas with limited effective governance. They're desperate for income and revenue generation, and so they're some of the more difficult areas like South America and Africa and Southeast Asia, propose and advance endangered species protection. I worked some in India writing a story on tiger conservation there years ago, and found that, when local communities had a stake in tiger conservation around these tiger reserves, it worked. And they stopped poaching, and they protected the tigers. When they realized that there was a financial benefit for them and having tourism developed for people coming to see the tigers instead of just having poachers poach them and sell the tiger bones and, to the Asian market, that it became a more lucrative thing for them to do to protect tigers than to have them killed. And so it changed the dynamic pretty dramatically, I think. So that's instructive, I think, to all of us. And the same sort of dynamic is being played out now across Africa, of course. So when local people see a benefit to conservation, then the pathway becomes pretty clear.
Well, Rick, we've just about run out of time, and I have a lot more questions to ask, so maybe we can do a session again next week, and we can talk some more. So thank you very much. It's been great to talk to you today, and we'll look forward to the next session. Our guest,
I appreciate it. Thanks very much, Jay.
Our guest today is Rick Steiner, retired professor at the University of Alaska, now leading the Oasis Earth Project to transition to an environmentally sustainable society. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com. You can see our website at js-wilderness.com. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.